he had never been. 2. I sailed this morning about 9 o'clock, and we are now something over 200 miles out, Wilbur wrote in a letter addressed to Catherine, but intended for all at home. The St. Louis and another ship started at the same time, but we have run off from them. The Campania, part of the Cunard line, was known as one of the finest vessels of its kind, and one of the fastest, a flying palace of the ocean, which Wilbur particularly liked. The ship was 622 feet in length, with 2 tall stacks, and burnt some 500 tons of coal per day. The predominant interior style was Art Nouveau, with staterooms and public rooms paneled in satinwood and mahogany, and thickly carpeted. The weather was splendid, the sea smooth, and he had a cabin to himself. With only about half the usual number of passengers on board, he was able to get a $250 cabin for only $100, and he was quite happy about that, too, even if Flint was covering expenses. We made 466 miles the first day, he wrote the following evening, and left the other boats out of sight. The third day out, he took a tour of the engine room, marveling at the scale of it all. Engines half as high as an office building back home. Engines that could deliver 28,000 horsepower. This in contrast to the 25 horsepower of the new engine for Flyer 3. There were 12 boilers and over 100 furnaces. The ship's propellers measured no less than 23 feet in diameter. He kept note of the miles made day by day, and walked the promenade deck 5 to 10 miles a day. Though he wrote nothing about the food served or the other passengers, he seemed to be having a fine time. All went ideally until the sixth day out, when a storm hit, and Wilbur had his first experience with pitch and roll on water, not in the air. The waves are probably 10 feet high, and the ship pitches considerably. Fortunately, there is but little roll. The spray was such that the promenade decks were useless. The ship had become more like a hospital, though he himself felt only a little sick just after breakfast. The last day at sea, off the Irish coast, he wrote of seeing gulls at intervals, and how they could skim within a foot or two of the waves, and in strong winds did not even have to flap their wings very much. After landing at Liverpool at first light Saturday, May 25, Wilbur went by train to London, where at Euston Station he was met by the Flint & Company sales representative, Hart O. Berg, an American who recognized Wilbur the moment he stepped off the train. I have never seen a picture of him, or had him described to me in any way, Berg would write to Charles Flint, and either I am a Sherlock Holmes or Wright has the peculiar glint of genius in his eye, which left no doubt in my mind as to who he was. Berg also noticed Wilbur's luggage consisted of a single leather grip the size of a doctor's bag, and his wardrobe left much to be desired. But on the way to the hotel, it was Wilbur who suggested it might be advisable for him to buy a new suit. At a tailor's shop in the Strand, Berg fixed him up with both a dress suit and a tuxedo. When Wilbur's account of these purchases reached home, Catherine wrote at once to tell him how Orv had marched off to Perry Meredith's haberdashery this morning and ordered the same for himself. Intent on wasting no time, Berg told Wilbur there was little likelihood of doing business in England, and the sooner they left for France, the better. The main effort would be made in Paris. They also found themselves disagreeing on the best approach, whether to deal with governments primarily or with individuals, Berg much in favor of individuals. Either way, both agreed it would be best not to make much of Wilbur's presence in Europe, not for the time being at least. Summing things up at the close of his long memorandum to Charles Flint, Berg stressed how pleased he was with Wilbur's whole bearing and attitude. "He inspires great confidence," Berg wrote. and I am sure he will be a capital Exhibit A. How Wilbur felt about Berg at this point is not clear. Though fellow Americans of roughly the same age, their backgrounds and experiences in life could hardly have been more different. Born to a Jewish family in Philadelphia and raised in New York, Berg had attended private schools until sent off to Europe to be trained as an engineer at Liège in Belgium. In the time since, he had become a pioneer in the manufacture of pistols, machine guns, automobiles, and submarines. He had worked at the Colt Firearms Factory in Hartford, Connecticut, maintained his own sales office in Paris, and spent 3 years in Russia, where he obtained orders from the Tsar for building 10 submarines. Where Wilbur was lean and rumpled, Berg was stout and immaculate in attire. Berg was fluent in several languages and well-connected, with contacts in high places throughout Europe. And though arms dealers, merchants of death, were an anathema to many, he seems to have been well-liked and respected by nearly everyone. Berg and his wife Edith, also an American, had lived in Paris for years, and the French held him in high regard. In 1901 he had been made a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor. From London to Dover, then across the Channel, Wilbur and Berg were joined by another Flint executive, Frank Cordley. They arrived in Paris on the evening of May 27, when it was still daylight, and checked into the luxurious Hotel Maurice on the Rue de Rivoli. "The Tuileries Palace and the Louvre are only a couple of squares to our left," Wilbur reported that same night to Catherine and the family. "The Column Vendôme is behind us, and the Place de la Concorde and Arc de Triomphe are farther up the Champs-Élysées. We are right in the most beautiful and interesting part of the city." He was also residing in one of the finest hotels in all Paris, indeed in all Europe. The new Hotel Maurice, as said, had only just reopened after major refurbishments. The old Hotel of Kings had been made more sumptuous than ever. Its restaurant, in decor and cuisine, was now one of the finest in the city, and a rendezvous of fashion. One could take a magnificent new elevator to a roof garden, and for panoramic views of Paris there were few to compare, or, for that matter, from those guest rooms fronting on the Rue de Rivoli, one of which, room 329, Hart Berg had reserved for Wilbur. "Stay in Paris and taste the pervasive charm, the freshness of beautiful summer nights. The sky, dusted with stars, is radiant," read an advertisement for the Maurice. "The electricity shines through little lampshades. The flowers give out a fragrance. We are only a few steps from the Concorde, but one would think himself so far away, transported into a town of dreams." Wilbur wrote nothing of the roof terrace, or the magnificent crystal chandeliers in the main dining room, or the fancy livery worn by the elevator operator. Interestingly, in all he would write about his time in Paris, he never mentioned his plush accommodations. Probably he had no wish to incite envy at home, or to magnify concern over his being corrupted by high living. Except for the hotel stationery in which his letters were written, one would never have known where he was staying. Nor did he make mention of the women of Paris, or the fashions on parade, or the shops, the opera, the theater, or the French in general, or the American tourists, of whom there were a great many. What he did write about in the days that followed, apart from all he reported on his dealings with Berg, Cordley, and the French, were the great buildings and art treasures of Paris, revealing, as he never had or had called to, the extent of his interest in architecture and painting. Like so many seeing Paris for the first time, he could not get enough of it, and covered more ground on foot than ever before. The 5 to 10 miles a day he walked on board ship would seem to have been only a warm-up. Whatever free time he had away from business, he was out and on his way. It was spring in Paris, the chestnut trees in bloom. From the Louvre to the Arc de Triomphe, was nearly 2 miles of gardens and esplanades, with thousands of statues, he wrote. He climbed the 300 steps to the top of the Arc de Triomphe, walked the banks of the Seine to the Ile de la Cité, walked to the Opera, walked down the Rue de Rivoli 2 miles to the Place de la Bastille. On a Sunday morning, he hiked to the top of Montmartre, a distance of nearly 2 miles that included more than 300 steps. He loved seeing so much open space used to set off important buildings. "Paris is the most prodigal of land for public purposes," he wrote in a long descriptive letter to Bishop Wright. There was much to be learned from the French about how to place public buildings. "There is always an open space as big as a city square in front of each building, and in addition there is nearly always a broad avenue leading directly to it, giving a view from a long distance. It is this, as much as the buildings and monuments themselves, that makes Paris such a magnificent city. If only a city like New York were arranged the same way. Even New York skyscrapers, like the Belmont and Knickerbocker hotels, if properly set, would be wonderful." He seems to have soaked up everything in view, and whatever he looked at closely. Some of the landmarks were a little shabby. Half the gilding was gone from the dome of Les Invalides, where Napoleon was buried. The same was true of the pedestal of the Egyptian obelisk in the Place Vendôme, and he was sorry to see so much of the statuary marred by black streaks. He spent considerable time at the Pantheon, which, he explained to Catherine, was not used as a church, but as commemoration of the great men of France. The dome, seen from inside, was not much, he decided. Too high in proportion to its diameter, like looking into an inverted well, but the interior was very grand. He took architecture seriously, thoughtfully, and made up his own mind, irrespective of whatever was said in his red Baedeker guidebook. Notre Dame was a disappointment. "My imagination pictures things more vividly than my eyes." He thought the nave too narrow, the clerestory windows too high, the interior far too dark. "The pillars are so heavy and close together that the double aisles on each side form no part of the room when you stand in the nave." "How amazing it was," he wrote in another letter, "to see thousands of people dining on the sidewalks up and down the avenues, sitting at little tables outside restaurants, sipping wine and eating in the open air, right on the sidewalks." Often, as the time passed, he was himself dining handsomely, as the guest of Hart Berg. There was Boivin on the Avenue de Cliché in Montmartre, Henri's on the Rue Volney, and the famous Café Anglais, where Wilbur enjoyed lunch with both Berg and Mrs. Berg. He would fill his free time in Paris to advantage, and with the same level of intensity he brought to nearly everything, making the most of every waking hour in what, for all he knew, might be his one and only chance for such an opportunity. Of all that Paris offered, it was the Louvre that he kept going back to, again and again, spending hours there and logging still more miles, walking the long galleries. His description of the paintings he saw could go on for pages, a sign, it would seem, of how much interest in art there was at home as well, and with Catherine in particular. He preferred the Rembrandts, Holbeins, and Van Dycks as a whole, better than the Rubenses, Titians, Raphaels, and Murillos. His disappointment in the Mona Lisa was as great as it had been in Notre Dame. "I must confess that the pictures by celebrated masters that impressed me most were not the ones that are best known." He much preferred Leonardo's John the Baptist to the Mona Lisa. Above all, he was taken with the work of the 17th-century Flemish master, Anthony van Dyck. In a letter written after a full afternoon at the Louvre, he moved on to a collection of 19th-century French masters, including Delacroix, Corot, Millet, and Courbet. "While I do not pretend to be much of a judge, I am inclined to think that in 500 years, the collection, will be recognized as some of the greatest work ever done. What appealed especially about Corot was the way he painted the sky. The sky was his source of light. Such keen interest as he had in art was not only remarkable in someone so committed to technical innovation, but a measure of a truly exceptional capacity of mind. As weeks, then months passed, Wilbur, of his own choice, visited the Louvre 15 or more times. What he did not report to those at home was the extent to which he was being scrutinized by the press and the stir he caused at public occasions. Any hope of anonymity was already gone. To a reporter from the Washington Post, who stopped him in the lobby of the Hotel Maurice, Wilbur refused to say anything about his machine or his plans. When the subject turned to the difference between flying and going up in a balloon, Wilbur said he had yet to go up in a balloon, that it was entirely another thing from flying, which affects one with intoxication. After having once flown, it is almost impossible to turn to anything else. In mid-June, he went with Hartberg to see the balloon races at Saint-Cloud. Amid a particularly elegant crowd, in which were to be seen Gustave Eiffel and the American ambassador Henry White, Wilbur drew more attention than anyone. A reporter for the Paris Herald asked, "You are over here on pleasure, are you not, Mr. Wright?" "To some extent," Wilbur said. "I am enjoying myself splendidly and seeing all manner of new things." "You like Paris? It is a marvelous city." "Mr. Wright talked carefully," the reporter wrote. It was obvious that he feared to be caught in a trap concerning his remarkable machine and what he wants to do with it. At the end of each question, his clean-shaven face relapsed into a broad, sphinx-like smile. That this same American bicycle mechanic from Ohio was spending hours with the masterpieces of the Louvre was apparently not of interest to the press. The business sessions arranged by Berg had begun their first full day in Paris. Wilbur had been taken to meet an active patron of ballooning with a strong interest in aviation, Henri Deutsch de Lemert, whom Wilbur described for Orville as the Standard Oil King of France. There were sessions with Arnold Fordyce, Commandant Bonnel, and officials of the French government. Berg was a pretty slick hand, Wilbur told Orville, and things were going well. Berg was very practical, and Wilbur liked the way he was always at hand to explain what was being said in French, and said so often at an extremely high speed. Berg could be depended upon to do his utmost. Besides, he was about as enthusiastic now as a man could be, and he really has a remarkable faculty for reaching people. The business talks often seemed endless, but thus far the prospects for an agreement looked encouraging. In general outline, the Wrights were to receive $350,000 for their flyer, once a public demonstration was made in France, before any agreement was struck. The French insisted on seeing the plane and seeing it operate, which was clearly their right. "The pot is beginning to boil pretty lively," Wilbur reported. But then one French faction tangled with another. Political intrigue intervened. Progress slowed. Not so many years before, Wilbur had decided he was unsuited for commercial pursuits. Now he found himself in the thick of extremely complex commercial dealings, playing for extremely high stakes, with highly experienced entrepreneurs, politicians, and bureaucrats, and in a language he neither spoke nor understood. The whole game, the players, the setting, the language, were all new to him. Yet he was more than holding his own and in good spirits, aware as he was of the derision to be found behind the scenes. At the War Ministry it was being said the Wrights were bluffers like all Americans, worthless people, trying to sell to France an object of no value, that even the Americans did not believe in. Alert, patient, closely attentive, Wilbur never rattled, as his father would say, never lost his confidence. He could be firm without being dictatorial, disagree without causing offense. Nor was there ever a doubt that when he spoke, he knew what he was talking about. Most importantly, he remained entirely himself, never straying from his direct, unpretentious way, and with good effect. If anything, his lack of French, his lack of sophistication, seemed to work to his advantage. He was indeed, as Hartburg had anticipated, a capital Exhibit A and more. That Wilbur neither drank or smoked or showed the least interest in women remained, of course, a puzzlement to the French. The whole while he was keeping those at home, and Orville in particular, fully abreast of all that was happening, by mail and by cable, often in lengthy detail, describing the various configurations of how they were to profit financially, depending on who put in what money. An experienced financial reporter could hardly have provided clearer coverage. For occasional relief, Hartburg would treat Wilbur to a pleasant chauffeur-driven drive with him and Mrs. Berg in their grand automobile through to Bois de Boulogne or out to Fontainebleau or Versailles. One Monday morning, while Wilbur was lying in bed, a hotel clerk knocked at the door to say a dirigible known as La Patrie was flying over Paris. La Patrie, as Wilbur knew, was the first airship ordered by the French army. He dressed at once and went up to the roof garden. La Patrie, the homeland, was a giant sausage-shaped gas bag with an open gondola for the crew hanging below. It passed over the Arc de Triomphe and almost directly over the Meurice at what Wilbur estimated to be 15 miles per hour. He judged it a very successful trial. But as he was shortly to write, the cost of such an airship was 10 times that of a flyer, and a flyer moved at twice the speed. The flying machine was in its infancy, while the airship had reached its limit and must soon become a thing of the past. Still, the spectacle of an airship over Paris was a grand way to begin a day. Most mornings only meant more meetings. The primary question at issue had become whether to sell to the French government or set up a commercial company with Henri Deutsch. The possibility of a contract with the government seemed all but certain until the French army insisted the flyer trial be conducted in winds too strong and demanded an exclusive agreement for 3 years, neither of which Wilbur would agree to. Then, for the first time, it became clear that Flint and Company was expecting a commission of 20%, not only on what they sold, as had been agreed on, but also on what the brothers retained. "Don't worry over Flint's commission," he told Orville. "We can hold them level." Next thing, Wilbur was informed confidentially that if he and Orville and their associates were to raise the price to the French government by $50,000, this sum could be distributed among persons who had the power to put the deal through. In other words, those in power would need to be bribed substantially. This Wilbur refused even to discuss. The longer the talk dragged on, the more obvious it became that little would ever be decided until a demonstration was staged, and Wilbur kept urging Orville to speed up progress at home. "I presume you will have everything packed and ready before this letter arrives," he wrote. "Be sure to bring everything needed in the way of spare parts. Bring Charlie Taylor along, of course, when you come. It will pay to have enough trustworthy assistance when we come to experiment." This was written on June 28. Wilbur had had no word from Orville for nearly a month. In a letter from Catherine dated June 30, he was to learn that things were not going at all well at home, that she and Orville felt left out of what was happening in Paris. "Orv can't work any. Orv was quite uneasy. Orv was unsettled, really crazy to know what is going on, wroth over how things were being handled in Paris without him. Clearly, she was too." She and Orville had lost all patience with Flint and Company, and questioned whether they could be trusted. She had had little or no experience with Jews, but having seen a photograph of Hart Berg, she wondered if he might be one. "I can't stand Berg's look," she wrote. "It has just dawned on me that the whole company is composed of Jews. Berg certainly looks it. A few days later, she let Wilbur know the situation at home had become even worse. She was nearing a crack-up, and it was largely his doing. What on earth is happening to your letters? Her letter became a storm of anger, blame, self-pity, and desperation far beyond her wrathy nature. She had had more than enough of the whole business. We are all so nervous and worn out with the suspense that we can't any of us keep from being cross. Orv and I regularly fight every time we get together for 5 minutes, and poor Daddy does nothing but advise us to be calm, Bessie, be calm, while he is so excited that he can't hear anything we say. She had never been so tired in all her life. I want to cry if anybody looks at me. Some of their letters to him were being returned because of the wrong address. Why couldn't you tell us sooner that you weren't getting your mail? It makes us desperate to sit here and be perfectly helpless while they, Flint and Company, are working every scheme they can to get advantage of you. What business had they getting you into that French business? You could have done better there by yourselves. I despise the whole lot of them. Orv is so worried and excited and tired out that I feel some concern about him. He can't stand this forever. Neither can you, for that matter. The problem, Wilbur would later explain privately in a letter to his father, knowing the bishop would understand, was that Orville appeared to be in one of his peculiar spells, and not really himself. The morning of July 17, from his room at the Maurice, Wilbur wrote a long reply to Catherine, setting straight for her and Orville the situation in Paris, how he was going about his part in it, his concern for them, how he had tried to spare them aggravation, and why they need not worry. It was noticeably candid and entirely confident in tone, and as revealing of his own estimate of himself as almost anything Wilbur ever wrote, his message being that he was the one on the scene in Paris, he was in command, knew what he was about, knew the people with whom he was dealing, and there was no call for those at home to get worked up. In view of the fact that I have written, alone, 3 or 4 times as many letters home as I have received from all of you together, he began, it is a little amusing to read your continual complaints that you get so few from me. In the 2.5 months he had been away, he had received, on average, a letter a week from home, whereas he had been writing to them 3 to 4 times a week, except for a 10-day stretch when things were in such an unresolved state that there was nothing to report. He had felt from the start, he continued, that anything he wrote to Orville would unsettle him, but he felt Orville had a right to know what was going on. As for Flint and Company, he did not remind Catherine and Orville, as he could have, that it was Orville who had most wanted to get involved with them in the first place. I have done what I know he would have done if he had been here and understood all the facts. In such cases, the man at a distance only does harm by trying to give instructions which do not fit the case. Within days after reaching Europe, he had felt confident he could handle the situation. His only worry was whether Orville would be ready to follow as quickly as possible with the machine. It is not my custom to voice complaints, but this business of never being ready has been a nightmare to me for more than a year. As for Berg and Cordley, they had at first considered him merely sort of an exhibit. But their eyes have gradually opened, and now they realize that I see into situations deeper than they do, that my judgment is often more sound, and that I intend to run them rather than have them run me. Now I control everything, and they give advice and assistance. In this role, they can be of great service to us, and I see no reason for breaking with them. He was very sorry that those at home were so worn down by excitement. He himself, he assured them, was feeling better than he had in several years. They must stop worrying. There was no need. In closing, he reported, arrangements had been made by some Americans for him to go that afternoon on his first balloon flight. They took off from the Aero Club grounds of Saint-Cloud, eventually sailing into the clouds to emerge at about 3,000 feet, out into bright sunshine and blue sky. It was higher in the sky by far than Wilbur had ever been, and the view was utterly spectacular. They were 50 miles from Paris by then, crossing open country. The alternations of rich brown, newly plowed soil, with green fields of grass and grains of different shades, and the light brown and yellow fields ready for harvest, made a wonderful picture, he wrote. He loved seeing the little towns, with their red tile roofs, and the white roads reaching off in every direction. They flew nearly 80 miles in just over 3 hours and landed in a wheat field about 10 miles west of Orléans. But beautiful as it had been, ballooning was not for him any more than it had been for Otto Lilienthal. Once on the ground, you had to hike to a nearby village, find somewhere to spend the night, then, because of the prevailing winds, go back to where you started by a slow local train. "What we are seeking is the means of free motion in the air, in any direction," Lilienthal had written. On the evening of the same day that Wilbur was heading back to Paris by train, Orville left Dayton on an overnight express for New York, also on his way to Paris. The Flyer 3 had at last been finished, packed, and shipped off to France, to be stored in the customs house at Le Havre until needed. Orville, as Catherine said, had gone off looking pretty well fizzled out. He had also, as he discovered en route, forgotten to bring Wilbur's hotel address in Paris. 3. Early on a Sunday morning in late July, the brothers were reunited. Having enjoyed an uneventful crossing on the steamer Philadelphia, Orville succeeded in finding his way to the Maurice, where he discovered Wilbur looking better than he had in years. Following breakfast at the hotel, they went for a long walk together, talking the whole time. They lunched at the Café Alcazar on the Champs-Élysées, after which they spent most of a sultry afternoon sitting and talking in the park along that boulevard. And by all signs, they succeeded in clearing the air between them. The following day, they met with Hartberg and Frank Cordley for what Wilbur described as a rather warm heart-to-heart talk, meaning it was extremely heated. They took up the matter of patents, Wilbur making it clear from the start that Flint & Company was in no way entering into a partnership with them. "We are, and intend to be, the sole owners of the patents," he said, according to his own notes on the conversation. They talked of expenses and of stock in the enterprise. "The point is this," Wilbur told Berg. "We do not intend you to own 20% of any stock. We intend to own the stock. You are the selling agents." And so it went back and forth, Berg making his case, Wilbur and Orville holding firm. From all Wilbur had reported and explained to him, and from his own judgment of Berg, and from the meeting, Orville had his suspicions absolved, his mind put to rest. He was ready to proceed with Wilbur, and as Wilbur directed. "Our friends F., Flint & Company, and B., Berg, are not in the bandit crew," Orville was glad to assure Catherine. Wilbur led Orville on a first stroll through the Louvre, and to celebrate Orville's arrival in Paris, Frank Cordley hosted an evening at the legendary and highly expensive Tour d'Argent by the Seine on the left bank, where a tableside preparation of duck, canard au sang, the main course, performed by the restaurant's celebrated owner chef, Frédéric Dallaire, seems to have made a far greater impression on Orville than anything he had seen at the Louvre. Dallaire worked in a formal tailcoat, and with his flowing side whiskers and pince-nez eyeglasses, looked, as Orville would report to Catherine, more like a college professor than a chef, and had a way of swinging his head as he carved up the duck into small pieces that in itself was worth the full price. "The legs, wings, and so forth," Orville continued, "are sent to another room where we cannot see them receiving the finishing touches, but the carcass, after most of the meat has been removed, is put in a fancy press, and all the juice and marrow extracted. The meat and juices are then placed over the alcohol flame, and cooked together, Mr. Frederick basting the meat the entire time. Finally, the duck is served, and with the enclosed card and folder, which gives the serial number of the duck we ate. When, in a letter, Bishop Wright expressed dire warnings over the temptations of Paris, Wilbur wrote to assure him they would do nothing to disgrace the training they had received at home, and that all the wine he had tasted thus far would not fill a single glass. "We have been real good over here," Orville added. "We have been in a lot of the big churches and haven't got drunk yet." Their prospects in France were at a low ebb, thanks in large part to the number of government officials departing for their customary August vacations. But with interest in Germany still active, Wilbur and Berg decided to leave for Berlin, departing August 4. On the way to Berlin, seeing a sign from the train window of the small town of Jemappes in Belgium, Wilbur began talking about the historic battle fought there in 1792, and to Berg's amazement, went on at length about the importance of the victory won by the army of the infant French Republic over the regular Austrian army. It was for Berg yet another example of the extraordinary reach of Wilbur's mind. He had read about it in his youth, Wilbur explained. A week later, when Charlie Taylor arrived, Orville had him check into a less conspicuous hotel on the Rue d'Alger, around the corner from the Maurice, and register simply as C.E. Taylor of Lincoln, Nebraska. "We do not want the papers or anyone here to know that he has come over," Orville wrote to Catherine. In the time since Orville's arrival, the press had been following the brothers everywhere, and it was becoming ever more bothersome. To the reporters, the brothers were like no one they had ever tried to cover. A correspondent for the London Daily Mail told Orville he was the toughest proposition newspapermen had yet run up against. He himself said the correspondent had already spent more money on cab fares, trying to learn what the brothers were up to, than he could ever hope to recover. But he could not give up, for fear some other reporter would get the scoop. In mid-August, when it looked as though French interest in an agreement had revived, Wilbur and Berg returned from Berlin. Still, there was no real progress with the French, nor had there been with the Germans. By early September, the brothers had little to do but bide their time, and to judge from what Orville recorded, they had become occupied primarily with sitting in the park watching the passing parade. If Wilbur had his Louvre, Orville had the Garden of the Tuileries. "You need not worry about me missing the use of the front porch," Orville wrote to Catherine. "I spend at least half of my time while awake in the park across from the hotel." There were hundreds of little iron chairs in the park, the rent for which was 2 cents a day, he explained. "A number of women are employed in going about to pounce down on every unsuspecting chap that happens to be occupying a chair and to collect the 2 cents." He especially enjoyed watching the French children, amazed by how well-behaved they were. He described the small merry-go-rounds, each operated by a man turning a crank, and thought it was pathetic that the children could so enjoy something so tame, hanging on as if riding a bucking bronco. Then every so often, along would come some American children to liven things up. "They jump off and on the horses while the affair is going at full speed, which is never fast, seize the rings by the handful, which they are supposed to spear one at a time with an ice pick, and when the ride is over, begin tossing the ice picks, I don't know what they are called here, about among themselves when the man comes to collect them, till the poor fellow that runs the affair is driven nearly crazy. Of course we feel ashamed of the youngsters," he added, "and know that they need a good thrashing, but it does seem pleasant to have something once in a while that is a little more exciting." Greatest by far was the spectacle of seeing so many children, men and women of all ages, playing with Diabolo, the simple age-old toy that had lately become all the rage. It consisted of a wooden spool, the shape of an hourglass, and 2 bamboo sticks about 2 feet in length, joined by a string 4 to 5 feet in length, and it cost about 50 cents. The player would slip the string around the spool, then, a stick in each hand, lift the spool from the ground and start it spinning, and by spinning it faster, keep it balanced in the air. It was because the spool would so often fall to the ground, until the beginner got the knack, that it was called the devil's game. It had originated in China 100 years or more earlier, and to the brothers, it was irresistible. The whole course of their lives, they like to say, had begun in childhood with a toy, and a French toy at that. And now here they were in middle age in France, enjoying themselves no less than if they were children still. With the Diabolo, the magic was not that the toy itself flew, as did Alphonse Pinault's helicopter. Here you yourself had to overcome the force of gravity with skill. You had to learn the trick by practice, and more practice with the sticks and string, to keep the spool flying. Just as an airplane was not enough in itself, one had to master the art of flying. The time the brothers devoted to playing Diabolo so publicly did not go unnoticed, and added still more to the growing puzzlement over Les Frères Mystérieux. The mystery of the rites, wrote the Paris Herald, remained as dense as ever, and quoted an American visitor who frequently observed them in the garden of the Tuileries and became convinced they had laid aside their flying machine and quit thinking about it. "Everybody knows," the man had said, "that when a person has contracted the Diabolo habit, he cannot possibly attend anything else." Apparently the brothers caught on quickly to the Diabolo art, and became quite good at it. But for Charlie Taylor, the spool kept falling to the ground 9 times out of 10. As for what else Charlie Taylor may have been doing to pass the time, besides Diabolo, there is no record. When Catherine read about the hours spent in the park, she bristled as a schoolteacher must. "You never told me whether you learned to talk any French," she wrote to Orville. "Instead of sitting around in the park everlastingly, it seems to me that I would have been getting around to see everything about Paris. Couldn't you get someone to talk French with you?" Just the same, she asked him, to be sure to bring home a Diabolo for her. His sense of humor plainly in play again, Orville told her he had indeed met a Frenchman in the park who spoke English, but that he thought it hopeless to try to learn both Diabolo and French at the same time. Schools had reopened in Dayton, Catherine was back in the classroom, and all was well at home, the atmosphere entirely different from what it had been. She and Father were getting along famously. He had bought a new typewriter. She had ordered a new stove. "You can stay as long as you please," she told the brothers. "What plans do you suggest?" Wilbur asked Orville at the end of September, in a letter from Berlin where he had returned again. "We cannot afford to spend much more time on negotiations, nor can we afford to return to America without some arrangements for our European business." So stay they did, and for a while Orville joined Wilbur in Berlin. Not until the start of November, back in Paris, did they decide it was time to go. But not before going with Hart Berg to see a demonstration put on by the French aviator Henri Farman. Monsieur Henri, a former artist, champion bicycle rider and automobile racer, who was considered Europe's outstanding pilot. Large crowds gathered at Issy-les-Moulineaux, southwest of Paris. Farman had been getting a great deal of publicity, and even in the United States. "Aren't you getting worried over Farman's flights?" Catherine had asked. Farman flew a biplane made by a French aircraft manufacturer, Voisin Frères. Many of his trials were unsuccessful. On the longer flights, he had trouble getting off the ground, and the same was true when trying to make a circle. But in one flight, he covered more than half a mile, and flew an almost complete circle. Yet from what he saw, Orville felt he and Wilbur had no cause to worry. When asked by a reporter what he thought, Orville said only that he and his brother never liked to pass criticisms on the work of others, and the time would show whether the methods used in the Farman machine were sufficient for strong winds. French aviation enthusiasts had no doubt, however, that France was now clearly in the lead. France could boast of the Voisin brothers, Gabriel and Charles, who had formed their aircraft company only that year, and other French aviators besides Henri Farman, including Léon Delagrange, who also flew a Voisin biplane, and Louis Blériot, who had taught himself to fly in a monoplane of his own design. Like Henri Farman, these French pilots flew in public and greatly to the public's delight. Also, quite unlike the Wright brothers, most of the pilots in France, Farman, Saintot-Dumont, Delagrange, Blériot, Comte Charles de Lambert, were men of ample private means for whom the costs of their aviation pursuits were of little concern. It seems that to the genius of France is reserved the glorious mission of initiating the world into the conquest of the air, said the president of the Aero Club. To his eminent fellow member of the club, Ernest Archdeacon, the Wright Flyer was no more than a phantom machine. For the time being, the Flyer III and all its parts would remain in storage at the customs house at Le Havre. Wilbur and Charlie Taylor left for home first. Orville followed soon after. Writing from on board the RMS Baltic, his spirits high, Wilbur told his father, "We will spend the winter getting some more machines ready for the spring trade. Then we will probably put out a sign. Opening day, all goods below cost. We will probably return to Europe in March, unless we make arrangements with the U.S. government before that." While Charlie went directly to Dayton after arriving in New York, Wilbur stopped off in Washington to check on developments there before reaching home in time for Thanksgiving. He was extremely pleased to report that at long last the U.S. Army was seriously interested in doing business. With the onset of a new year, all that the brothers had worked to achieve in the way of sales agreements began to happen. On February 8, 1908, their bid of $25,000 for a flyer was at last accepted by the War Department. Then, less than a month later, on March 3, they signed an agreement with a French company to be known as La Compagnie Générale de Navigation Aérienne, with the understanding that public demonstrations of the flyer in France would follow by midsummer. Chapter 8. Triumph at Le Mans. "Gentlemen, I'm going to fly." Wilbur Wright. 1. I am on my way to Kitty Hawk to get a camp in shape for a little practice before undertaking the official trials at Washington and in France, Wilbur wrote to Octave Chanute from Elizabeth City on April 8, 1908. The decision to proceed for the first time with large public demonstrations of their flyer, as important and difficult a step as the brothers had yet faced, had finally been made, and a little practice was indeed called for. Neither had flown a plane for 2.5 years, not since the fall of 1905. Though he had been forewarned that the camp at Kildevil Hills was in shambles, what Wilbur found was worse than he had imagined. Of the original building, only the side still stood. The new building was gone, carried off by violent storms, or vandals who figured the brothers were never coming back. The water pump was gone. The floors of both buildings had disappeared under more than a foot of sand and debris. Walking among the ruins, he kept turning up pieces and parts of the 1901, 1902, and 1903 machines. It was an altogether discouraging prospect to face, and particularly one might imagine for somebody who had so recently resided at the Hotel Maurice. He arranged a room temporarily at the Kildevil Hills life-saving station, and with the help of two local carpenters, began building anew. High winds, driving rain, and a severe attack of diarrhea made things no easier. Conditions are almost intolerable, he wrote in his diary. Nor did the fact that so many of those he and Orville worked with in earlier years had either died or moved away. Bill Tate was tied up with work of his own. John T. Daniels had transferred to the Nag's Head life-saving station. Dan Tate had died. A Dayton mechanic the brothers had hired to help, Charlie Furness, appeared on the scene, and by Saturday, April 25, the day Orville arrived, bringing the crated parts of the flyer, the camp was close to ready. "Spent afternoon cleaning out trash and making the building habitable," Wilbur recorded in his diary. "I slept in a good bed of regular camp pattern. Orville slept on some boards thrown across the ceiling joist. Furness slept on the floor. Each pronounced his own method a success." The morning of Monday, April 27, was spent uncrating boxes, brushing off wings, and setting up a workbench. That afternoon they repaired a few ribs broken in transit and began sewing the lower sections together. Mounting the engine and chain guides and work on the launching track occupied another several days. The big change this time was that the flyer had been modified to carry two operators. They were to ride sitting up, side by side, primarily to provide better control over the wing warping. It also meant no more stretching flat on their stomachs, straining their necks to see ahead. The wind resistance would be greater, but the advantages counted more. In the 3 weeks since Wilbur arrived on the Outer Banks, not a single reporter had appeared. Then the Norfolk Virginian pilot ran a wholly fabricated story, picked up by newspapers everywhere, that the Wright brothers, back again at Kitty Hawk, had already made a 10-mile flight out to sea against a wind of 15 miles an hour. In no time the rush of the press was on to the Outer Banks. In the lead was a young freelance reporter for the New York Herald, D. Bruce Sally, who could now be seen crouching among the scrub pine on a distant hill, spying on the camp with field glasses. Test flights got started on May 6. Orville went first and flew just over 1,000 feet. 2 days later, taking turns, he and Wilbur both were making flight after flight until interrupted by Sally, who came rushing into camp, unable to contain his excitement over what he had seen. Once he left, Wilbur took off again and flew more than 2,000 feet. A stream of reporters kept arriving. The advance of the press on their lives, a factor the brothers would have to contend with for years to come, had begun in force. The reporters to be seen hanging about on the hills with field glasses and telescopes represented the New York Times, the New York American Weekly, the New York World, Collier's, Technical World, the Paris Herald, and the London Daily Mail. A writer named Byron Newton, sent by the Paris Herald, did full justice to the wild and unimaginably remote setting he and the others found themselves confronted by after landing at Manteo on Roanoke Island. "The Wrights, we found, were some 12 or 14 miles distant from that point, among the great sand dunes on the coast near Kitty Hawk life-saving station. Their place was on the narrow stretch of marsh and jungle that lies between the Atlantic and the mainland. I have never viewed or traversed a more forbidding section of country. To reach this stretch of land, we had to cross Roanoke Sound in an open boat, and then walk about 6 miles, at times climbing over great mountains of gleaming white sand. And other times we were forced to pick our way through swamps and jungle infested with poison snakes, mosquitoes, wild hogs, and turkeys, with the air heavy with fever-breeding vapors. Killdevil Hills and Kitty Hawk seemed the end of the world," wrote the correspondent for Collier's Weekly, Arthur Rule, who then stressed that this end of the world had in fact become the center of the world because it was the touchable embodiment of an idea, which, presently, is to make the world something different than it has ever been before. It was not newspaper reporters, he said, but the world's curiosity that had ridden, climbed, waded and tramped all those miles, and now lay hiding there, hungry and peering across the intervening sands. There was something weird, almost uncanny, about the whole thing, wrote another correspondent. Here on this lonely beach was being performed the greatest act of the ages. But there were no spectators, and no applause, save the booming of the surf and the startled cries of the seabirds. Wilbur and Orville wondered why the reporters remained at such a distance. Only later were they told that it had been said the brothers kept rifles and shotguns at the ready to guard their machine. Asked what he and Wilbur would have done had the correspondents come into camp and sat there to watch, Orville replied, "We couldn't have delayed our work. There was too much to do and our time was short." Describing what the scene looked like from where they were posted, another of the correspondents wrote of dazzling white sand dunes, almost monumental. To the right, and to the left in the distance, more sand dunes, and a glimpse of the sea, and the Carolina sun pouring down out of a clear blue sky, immersed everything in a shimmer and glare. The two brothers, moving their machine about near the shed, looked like two black dots. The engine, when it started up, sounded like that of a reaper working a distant field. The propellers flashed and whirled, and the next thing, the plane swept by, fast as an express train. "We were all seasoned campaigners in the field of unexpected events," wrote the Paris Herald correspondent Byron Newton. But for all that, this spectacle of men flying was so startling, so bewildering to the senses in that year 1908, that we all stood like so many marble men. A photographer for Collier's Weekly, James Hare, snapped what would be the first photograph ever published of a Wright flyer in the air. Early the morning of May 14, the onlookers were treated to a sight never before seen anywhere. Two men in a motor-powered flying machine, when Wilbur took Charlie Furness up for a short ride. To the newsmen from their distant vantage point, it appeared that Wilbur and Orville had taken flight together, and so some of their dispatches reported. But the brothers, ever conscious of the risks involved, had already decided they must never fly together. That way, if one were to be killed, the other could still carry on with the work. Days as hot as summer had returned to the Outer Banks, and that afternoon, when Wilbur went up alone, the heat was nearly unbearable. Flying at something over 50 miles per hour, he made one big circle and was starting into another when, still unfamiliar with the new control levers, he made a mistake with the rudder and suddenly plunged to the ground about a mile from camp. "I was watching with a field glass," Orville would recount. "The machine turned on end, the front end, with a tail in the air. There was a big splash of sand, such a cloud that I couldn't see from where I was exactly what had happened. It was probably 30 seconds before Will appeared." He had been violently thrown against the underside of the top wing and had to be pulled from the wreckage. There was a cut across his nose, and though hit hard and bruised on both shoulders, an arm and one hand, he was not seriously injured. No bones were broken. The plane, however, was a total wreck. And thus, as Wilbur announced, the tests had come to an end. 2 days later, he was on his way again. It was agreed that he would go to France to proceed with the required demonstrations there, and that Orville would do the same in Washington. During little more than a week of test flights at Killdevil Hills, he and Orville had been the subjects of far more attention and praise in the press than they had ever known. They had become a popular sensation. Still, no major public performance had yet been made. The rabbit had still to be pulled from the hat for all to see. Passage was arranged for him on the Terrain, Wilbur reported to Catherine from New York. "I hate like anything to go away without first coming home." Right often, she told him in response. Don't come home without getting me several pairs of gloves. Number 6, black and white, short and long. Don't get them unless they are cheap.